You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
As was, I'm Josh Lerner, who's organizing this event with Martin. And we're, you know, as was sort of adeptly pointed out earlier, you know, we do have very much a sort of theme of the entrepreneurial circle here in terms of really beginning with the, you know, sort of founding in early days and then sort of going through the life cycle. And this sort of very much brings us to the process of going public. And in a lot of ways, I think you can argue that this is really the crucial part in the process because, as was the comment was made in the earlier panel, that it's all ultimately about returns, and without liquidity, one isn't going to have much in terms of returns. So, you know, certainly the IPO market has been an area that's been fraught with issues or challenges in the last dozen years or so, and we have the man to talk about the subject matter in the form of Jay Ritter. Jay is the Cordell Professor of Finance at University of Florida, but he's sort of known in academic circles certainly as Mr. IPO, and he's got no shortage of insights to share. He's also been very involved in the policy process and its various manifestations from, you know, certainly having done a variety of stuff, both regarding, you know, from the SEC to the New York Attorney General's office and lots of other interesting places in between. So as a result, certainly very much combines both, you know, academic and practical insight of these issues. And without further ado, Jay, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Josh. I'm going to talk about re-energizing the IPO market, and this is partly based upon an academic working paper that I have with Xiaowei Gao and Zhongyan Zhu called Where Have All the IPOs Gone? Re-energizing the IPO market is aimed more at the policy issues, and I've got a companion paper that will be published in Brookings Papers volume that will be coming out in a couple of months. Okay. This graph gives the number of IPOs, the bars, per year from 1980 through 2011. And what you see is from 1980 to 2000, an average of 310 companies went public every year. And over the last 11 years, which I'll call casually the last decade, ever since the tech bubble burst, an average of only 99 companies have been going public each year in the United States. You know, a huge drop. And this is even more disturbing when you take into the account the fact that U.S. real GDP has grown by 120% from the early 80s and until now. So if anything, you would have expected not a fall off in the annual volume of IPOs, but an increase over time. The blue line there gives the average first day return, which with the exception of the bubble period, has averaged about 11% per year and has been fairly stable during the last decade. Now, if we take IPOs and divide them into big and small companies using a very tiny borderline, only $50 million in inflation-adjusted pre-IPO annual sales, where it turns out about half of the companies over the last 32 years have been below that cutoff and half above that cutoff. What you see is that from 1980 to 2000, most years, about the same number of small firms and large firms went public, although on average, slightly more small firms. But in the last decade, small firm volume has been almost non-existent. This was true even during the 2004 to 2007 period when the stock market had largely recovered. And this is still true in 2012. In a few weeks when I update this graph, 2012 is going to be coming in just like 2011. And this has policymakers concerned, the venture capital community concerned, entrepreneurs concerned, that we've gone this long time period in both up cycles and down cycles with the IPO market being nowhere near like it used to be. And was just discussed previously. Historically, a lot of young companies that venture capitalists backed, successful companies exited via an IPO. And this has just not been much of an alternative in the last decade. And it doesn't look like it's changing. And this partly motivated the Jobs Act, which was passed in April. My personal view is the Jobs Act will have approximately no effect on IPO activity, and let me explain why. And this has been a policy issue, you know, for years. Many of us can remember 6 years ago when the New York versus London debate was going on. In fact, Chuck just mentioned about companies going public in London and Hong Kong. Although, when you look at the data more carefully, there just haven't been many U.S. companies going public overseas, and indeed, the vast majority of companies that have gone public on London's AIM market would have been rejected by NASDAQ as just too small that, and in fact, almost all of them amount to just private placements sold to qualified institutional buyers, and no public market ever really develops for them. And since the panic of 2008, European IPO volume has been very low, you know, partly due to the Eurozone crisis, but investors have earned very low returns on AIM IPOs, and kind of the consensus is London is not going to be coming back the way it had been 6 years ago. Now, this graph gives from 1990 through 2011 the number of successful exits by venture capital-backed companies. This is not including write-offs, but the green on top gives the fraction of successful exits that are IPOs, and the purple on bottom gives the percentage of exits that are trade sales, selling to Microsoft or Merck or Oracle rather than taking the company public. And what you see is that during the 1990s, there was a very substantial trend going on where taking companies public was becoming less and less common and selling out was becoming more and more common. Now, this is the percentage of exits. It turns out that at least in the last 15 years, the number of exits has been pretty stable, 300, 400 per year. So if we were just graphing the raw number of companies, that the patterns would not look too much different. But, you know, this is what the venture capitalists are talking about, that, you know, as an exit, IPOs have become very uncommon. Okay. This graph gives in purple here a measure of stock market valuations. It's the Shiller price-earnings ratio, which is the level of the S&P 500 divided by the inflation-adjusted 10-year moving average of earnings to smooth out business cycle effects. If instead I had plotted the market-to-book ratio for the stock market, the pattern would look virtually identical. And what you see is the big stock market rally of the 1980s and 1990s, the tech bubble burst, the 2008 financial panic, et cetera. And also graphed is scaled IPO volume per quarter. This is the number of companies going public each quarter divided by real GDP. And what you see, if you look at things like in the bull market in the end of 1982 led to a huge increase in IPO volume, You see the spikes up and down are very closely associated with stock market rallies and stock market falls. The IPO market tends to be hypersensitive to stock price movements. But what you see as well is starting not in 2000, but actually in about 1997, that IPO volume hasn't been keeping up with that historical relation, both in terms of the level and the sensitivity. When the stock market goes up now, only a few more companies go public. It's still the case that when the stock market goes down, IPO activity grinds to a halt, but the amplitude of the variation has dropped off dramatically with low volume, bull market and bear market year after year. And as I just pointed out, this trend had actually begun before the 2000 tech bubble burst. And indeed, when stock prices were so high in the late 90s, IPO volume actually was pretty modest compared with the historical relationship, given how high tech stock prices had gotten. Well, the conventional wisdom, based upon the logic for the Jobs Act, if you read the Wall Street Journal editorial page, the conventional wisdom is that Sarbanes-Oxley and other regulations have imposed very stiff costs on publicly traded small companies, and a combination of technological changes in the way stocks are traded and regulatory changes have drastically lowered bid-ask spreads and reduce the amount of analyst coverage of small companies. And this has led to the collapse of what's sometimes known as the IPO ecosystem. That in the 80s and 90s, there were a lot of San Francisco-based boutique underwriters, Hambrecht & Quist, Roberts & Stevens, Montgomery Securities, et cetera, that took lots of tech companies public. Elsewhere, Alex Brown, based in Baltimore, took a lot of other small growth companies public. And in the mid and late 1990s, a lot of the big commercial banks bought up these boutiques, and they really haven't been replaced, making it harder and harder for smaller companies to find reputable investment banks to take companies public. And so some proposals have been that, well, we need to somehow subsidize analyst coverage. We need to bring back the IPO ecosystem, and this will jumpstart the IPO market again. Well, I and my co-authors call these arguments the regulatory overreach hypothesis, that well-meaning regulations designed to protect investors have had some unintended consequences harming the IPO market. And I think there is some truth to this, but I'm largely inclined to believe that these are fairly minor effects. Instead, I think that there's a long-term change that's been going on where economies of scope have become more important, economies of scope being defined as related businesses can do things more cheaply if they're combined into one business rather than as separate independent companies. There's been an increasing importance of speed to market. Product half-lives have been getting shorter and shorter, especially in the technology space. And basically, getting big fast is more important than it used to be. And so our argument is that as a consequence of these things, the profitability of small independent firms has declined relative to the value created as part of a larger organization that can quickly implement new technology and benefit from economies of scope and scale. As a result, small firms are selling out rather than staying independent. So in other words, what I'm arguing is the problem isn't a public market versus private market issue. It's a big company versus small company issue. And increasingly, being a small independent company and growing organically is not the profit-maximizing business strategy, that instead getting big fast is the value-maximizing strategy, and the way to do that is typically to merge, either merging with other companies to grow rapidly or, most commonly, being acquired. And there are all sorts of facts that are consistent with this. We call our explanation the economies of scope hypothesis. Okay. Now, what's the evidence? This is, starting in 1980, the percentage of seasoned public companies, companies that have been publicly traded for at least 3 years with negative earnings. And here we're defining companies, big and small, based upon $250 million of fiscal year sales. And what you see is for large companies on the bottom, it's been increasingly common to lose money. There's a little bit of an uptrend there, and there are definitely business cycle effects. And the top line for smaller companies, there's also an uptrend. And this uptrend was going on before 2000. There's not a discrete event that smaller companies have been having more and more trouble being profitable. Now, there have been accounting changes that have gone on. For instance, in 2005, employee stock options started to get expensed, but you don't see any dramatic change in 2005. The trend was going on before then. Starting in 2002, Sarbanes-Oxley costs came into effect. We've asked, well, what would the numbers look like if we backed out compliance costs due to Sarbanes-Oxley? That's where you get the dotted lines here, where, as you can see, if companies had lower compliance costs, a higher percentage of them would be profitable, a smaller fraction of them would be unprofitable, but you know, the trend is still there. Okay. What about for the companies going public? Here we've got the large firm IPOs, the small firm IPOs as well, and what you see is the uptrend going on there, especially for small companies. A bigger and bigger percentage of them have been reporting negative earnings. And this trend was going on in the 80s and 90s. You know, technology has been changing gradually, where getting big fast has become more and more important, and there's no one discrete event that is associated with this. This is a technological argument, not a regulatory argument. And in the bigger picture scheme of things, this is related to why the distribution of income and wealth is getting more right skewed, not only in the United States, but in the world as well. Increasingly, in many businesses, it's more of a winner-take-all market where, you know, how many of you want to go out and buy the eighth best smartphone because it's a little bit cheaper than the products that Samsung and Apple sell? I think smartphones are a classic example of where getting big fast and winner-take-all really makes sense. And there's a little company, Android, that figured this out as well. They came up with some good technology. One of the things they could have done is raised more money, gone public, developed a better product, and maybe 3 years from now brought a smartphone with their operating system to market. Instead, what did they do? Well, they said, you know, we'll bet Samsung or Apple or Google would be willing to pay now a lot more money and incorporate our technology into their products right away. And indeed, they went out and talked to those firms, and Samsung turned them down, said, nah, we've got 500 PhD scientists. We don't need to buy outside technology. Google decided, yeah, we'll buy this. And Samsung greatly regrets their decision. Google views the Android acquisition as the best acquisition they have ever made. And Android's founders have no regrets about having sold out rather than to build an independent company. Okay. Now, what about the costs of compliance? Well, you know, if Sarbanes-Oxley costs were really burdensome, we would expect to see a lot of publicly traded small companies going private. This is a graph from 1980 until now of companies that went public and how many of them went private within 3 years of the IPO. And what you can see is it's not many. It averages only about 1 or 2% per year. And in particular, there's no increase after 2002 that of companies that do go public that get delisted. Typically, it's because they're either failing or because they're bought out rather than by deciding to go private as an independent company. Okay. Young growth firms that do go public are more likely to be acquired or to make acquisitions, and this is a trend that was going on in the 1990s as well. In terms of analyst coverage after the IPO, for both small firms and big firm IPOs, analyst coverage has been close to universal. Now, there is a bit of selection bias here. Certainly there are some small companies that didn't go public because they couldn't get a promise of analyst coverage from a reputable underwriter. I do believe that the minimum threshold size to be a publicly traded company, to make it optimal to do so, has gone up over time. But still, the huge drop in the number of small companies going public seems to be just too big to explain by mere increases in regulatory costs. And of venture capital-backed companies, they're not selling out to private equity shops and remaining as independent companies. Most importantly, they're selling out in trade sales. They're selling out to the Oracles and the Mercks and the Googles of the world, where the bigger organizations can integrate the technology and create value. What if lack of analyst coverage was resulting in lower public market valuations? Well, then we ought to see this in the price-earnings ratios of publicly traded companies. This graph shows for small companies and big companies with positive earnings. So this is excluding all of the companies with negative earnings, but what the price-earnings ratio is, and what you can see over time, this is 1980 through 2011, the vast majority of years, small companies with positive earnings sell at a little higher price-earnings ratio than for big firms, but that relation doesn't seem to be much different now than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So I don't think that it's lower valuations of publicly traded small firms that are deterring small companies from going public. So what are the policy implications? There have been a lot of proposals out there to subsidize analyst coverage, maybe even create special requirements with minimum bid-ask spreads for small companies. Our analysis indicates that these are not going to be very effective at generating a lot of IPO activity because it's not a public market versus private market issue. It's a big company versus small company issue. Our analysis suggests that companies are not going public because they have less value as a small independent company than they would have as part of a larger organization. So to conclude, I don't think there's any one explanation that accounts for all of the prolonged drought in IPO activity, but I do think that the regulatory overreach hypothesis has been overplayed. And maybe I'm wrong here. Personally, I hope I am wrong. I would really like there to be a lot of small company IPOs, but On the other hand, I don't see the problem being that lots of profitable small businesses are having difficulty raising money. I don't see venture capitalists demanding onerous terms and earning huge rates of return on the capital that they're investing. Overall, I don't see the problem as a shortage of capital. I see it as a problem with lack of profitable small businesses, and in particular, lack of rapidly growing profitable small businesses. I think there are a lot of small businesses with good technologies that are being funded, and then they sell out to larger organizations and realize value that way. So I think there has been a structural change going on, and I think a lot of policymakers are stuck in a mentality of, well, traditionally successful young companies went public, therefore that's the way it should always be. But I think the world has changed, and that model is not necessarily the best way of financing young companies and creating growth and facilitating job creation. Thank you. Okay, we've got some time for questions. Yes.
From a policy point of view, is there more job creation and more value creation in companies continuing independent as an IPO as opposed to being acquired? The research on value creation in M&A is that, depending on what study you agree with, that there's a tremendous amount of value leakage and value loss after acquisition. So if our goal is economic growth and job creation, are we better off to create policies to incent job creation is through IPO and independent companies than through M&A?
Yeah, you're asking a very important question, and I think it's really difficult to answer that question. Last year, I and co-authors did a study for the Kauffman Foundation looking at job creation after the IPO for all of the companies that went public from 1996 until now. And we found that the actual numbers are a lot lower than the numbers that the VC lobby had bandied about during the run-up to the Jobs Act and that the Wall Street Journal kept reporting. But in doing that, just like Josh Lerner's study on how many jobs do private equity firms create in their portfolio companies, it's easy to measure for some companies. But what do you do with the companies that go bankrupt? What do you do with the companies that get acquired? And a lot of companies get acquired, and then the acquiring company, like Oracle, they report their total employment. They don't report how many are in this division, how many were employed by this company that is the remnants of a company that we acquired 3 years ago. So it's just incredibly difficult to answer that question. But just like with venture capital investing, the fact that the majority of M&A transactions wind up being disappointments for the acquirer, that doesn't bother me. If every once in a while an Android acquisition comes along, that can balance out a lot of failures. And it's really difficult to figure out on average what happens. Yeah, I don't want to defend existing regulations as the optimal regulations. Personally, I'm glad I'm not a policymaker who has to figure out all of the trade-offs to try and get the right balancing between capital formation and investor protection. My inclination is to think that some of the regulations are too heavy-handed. Something that constantly hear from public companies is the fear of lawsuits. I'm inclined to think there are too many class action lawsuits. But on the other hand, when you look at the numbers for how much do companies have to pay in directors and officers insurance, the numbers are not staggeringly large, and they have not increased dramatically from the 1990s. So that leads me to think it is a bit of a problem, but I don't think this is the first order problem. The main problem is as product half lives have gotten shorter, it's harder and harder to have a profitable business and grow organically. And you know, the trends have been going on there for a long time with more and more M&A activity. There was not any discrete change in 2000 or a discrete change in 2009, and these patterns are not unique to the United States either. So I think explanations that focus exclusively on what's going on with U.S. publicly traded companies and their regulations are focusing too much on the trees. That's not to say that the regulations aren't in need of some changes, but I think that's largely a second-order effect. Yes.
Thank you. Trying to paint a sort of larger picture, do you think that one possible explanation is that that there is a structural weakness of the U.S. economy in this case, or the Western economy in general, following the dot-com boom and the bust cycle of the early 2000s, that companies don't grow organically, as you say, because there are not so many companies that can actually grow organically and survive in the current business environment and turn out to be bad investments in the first place?
Well, I think one of the things that has changed when I talk to venture capitalists and growth equity people and entrepreneurs, especially in the high-tech sector, is they're, in general, comfortable with the build-to-sell model for a number of reasons. One reason is they say, especially in the B2B space, business-to-business, it's really difficult to, if you've got a good technology, to market it to a lot of companies. You know, why should they take the risk of buying your unknown product rather than something that the Oracle sales team has put the Oracle brand name behind? Whereas if you sell your technology to Oracle and Oracle integrates it into their suite of products, first of all, you've got the certification there of the Oracle brand name, and Oracle can generate a lot more sales, and Oracle consequently is willing to pay a higher price for your company than it's worth as a standalone entity. You know, this is basically the problem of, you know, in a world of information asymmetries, opaqueness, you know, how do you convince others to believe your story? Where you have certain middlemen who do the vetting, do the due diligence, do the certification. And one way this is done is through getting big companies with the brand names to stand behind the product. And a lot of big companies have also found that, you know, the internal rate of return we've been earning on our in-house R&D has not been that great, especially in the pharmaceutical industry. So increasingly, they've been cutting their R&D spending and instead essentially outsourcing it by being more willing to buy independent growth companies when they think there's a good technology there.
But
so
how's that different from about 10 or 15 years ago? I mean, those constraints that you cite were there already, don't you think?
Yeah, I think the trend was disguised for a while by the technology bubble of the late 1990s, where basically public market investors were willing to overpay for small, independent, and big technology companies as well. So I think that's part of it. But also I think, in fact, the speed of technological change has gotten faster and product half-lives have gotten shorter, where the certification of, you know, taking advantage of that opportunity now has become more important. And I think that's part of the reason why this is more of an issue now than it was 15 years ago. Microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. In your research, did the issue of antitrust come up at all, meaning that some of these bigger companies are pretty much going after the competition when they buy a smaller company, whether it's securing an intangible asset like a patent or a trademark, just to put them out of business and grow market share? So could you share if there are any insights regarding that and, I guess, my perceived or my perception that antitrust sort of doesn't exist anymore?
Okay. I think these are important issues. Patent and copyright policy comes into play as well. Josh Lerner has done a lot of insightful work on that. And this gets back to one of the issues that Martin raised in his question about, you know, how much of this is fundamental technology versus how much of it is government policy that essentially subsidizes the big at the expense of the small. I think there are some issues there where, you know, the fixed costs of compliance does result in the optimal scale of the firm being bigger. On the other hand, I think there's some countervailing trends where it's easier than ever to start up a company, all sorts of things you can buy off the shelf, download from the cloud, rather than going out and spending the money to buy all sorts of computer servers yourself. So there are some offsetting trends that make it easier than ever to start up a business. Okay. Nothing. Yeah.
If these deals, you kept talking about the disappointing deals. If these deals are so disappointing, why are firms continuing to buy them?
That's one of the counter arguments for why I don't think that it's a public market failure. I'm hard pressed to think that Oracle and Cisco Systems and Microsoft, et cetera, are time after time consistently overpaying out of empire building perceptions or whatever. That one thing that you can measure is the returns that public market investors have earned on small company IPOs. And the evidence there is consistent, really bad, in both the U.S. and Europe. In the U.S., in the 1980s, small company IPOs underperformed. In the 1990s, they underperformed. In the bubble years, they underperformed. And this decade, they've underperformed even worse than in the 80s and 90s, even though there have been fewer of them. And the long-run returns on small companies in Europe, especially on London's AIM, have been abysmal for investors, both in the late 90s and this decade as well. So if it was just a matter of depressed public market valuations, you might expect, well, if companies have to sell at a low price earnings ratio, investors would then earn high returns. Instead, the fundamental problem is the inability of so many of the companies to earn money, or many of the, you know, we get back to the skewness issue. Even if the majority of them were failures, if there were a few that became the big successes, the 10 baggers for public market investors, that could offset the fact that the median does not do that well. But I'm hard-pressed to name many companies that went public when they were less than $50 million in annual sales that became big successes. You know, Google, eBay, et cetera, lots of them were already pretty successful companies when they went public. Josh?
One of the trends we've seen the last few years has been companies waiting to go public until they're much older. You know, so obviously Facebook was a visible example, but one can think about many other examples as well. Do you see that as a healthy thing or consistent with your ideas? How do you make sense of that sort of tendency of these really old young companies?
I think partly it reflects public market skepticism. Investors have learned that the track record of small, young companies that have gone public has not been very good. Consequently, I think it's made it more difficult for a good young company to go public at an early stage and get a high valuation. And given that difficulty and given the willingness of venture capitalists to fund them, many of them have decided, we are going to wait until we've got more of a track record so that public market investors would be willing to pay up for us just as the venture capitalists are willing to pay up for us now. So I don't necessarily view this as a public market failure. To some degree, I view it as a private market success, that there is sufficient private market capital there to finance good companies. But it's still the case that the majority of them are then exiting not by going public and remaining as an independent company. They're instead selling out in a trade sale. Okay. One last question.
I'm not sure that public ownership is actually a very good form of ownership for small companies, because I think they need more patient capital in order to grow, frequently being in a position of needing to take their earnings down to invest for growth. And, you know, if you have quarterly shareholder meetings, you know, you can't do that. So I think that's a contributing factor to the underperformance.
I would agree with you on that, although it's not clear to me why this has been different the last decade than it was in the 80s and 90s. For those of us who are older, we remember the late 1980s when it was impossible to pick up a copy of Business Week magazine without a story talking about how great the Japanese economy was, because companies there didn't have to focus on quarterly earnings. So while I do think that this is a very valid issue for public companies, I'm not sure that it's different now than it was a decade or two or three ago. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, panelists.
After many delays, I think we can hang loose. Thanks, Scott. That way I can keep a careful eye on you. We finally get to the real people here, the people who have the money. And in particular, in some sense, up until now, we've largely been sort of focused either on the perspective of the entrepreneurs or on the private equity guys and the other intermediaries who are providing the funding. But in a lot of ways, you can say the most critical people in the process are really the people who have the dollars. Now, they popped up a little bit in conversations, but as we were talking about among ourselves, we're not sure we always agreed with the way that they were characterized, and it seemed it was important to hear from their own words how they're seeing this whole realm of, you know, sort of venture growth capital investing, what their perspectives on it are, and so forth. We're very fortunate in having what you might describe as an all-star group of panelists here who really represent not just simply three countries, but also some of the, you know, sort of really classic investors in each of the respective types of investing here. And we're going to sort of dig into a series of questions about what's going on, how the landscape is changing, and what their perspectives are on these issues. Everyone got the biographies, and the biographies sort of lay out clearly what all the backgrounds of the backgrounds of the key players are. But what I thought would be helpful is maybe we'll just ask
each of the panelists to spend, you know, sort of 30 seconds on, you know, maybe a bit about themselves and their organizations, really just sort of the Reader's Digest version of the key aspects, and then we'll sort of get into the questions, and we're going to really mix it up here in terms of stuff. Eric, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Thank you, Josh. I'm Eric Dopstadt. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of the Ford Foundation in New York City. We're the, I guess my mic isn't working. Hello? Not working.
Get on the mic. Got a mic?
The Ford Foundation is the
second largest private foundation in the United States. And I think what's noteworthy for this discussion is that we were the first endowed institution to invest in venture capital and private equity going back over 40 years ago. And my experience at Ford spans close to half of that time frame. So I've seen a lot of the cycles come and go across the private equity and venture capital markets.
Thanks. I'm okay. All right. Okay, well, I'll just operate in the shadow here. Thank you. I was in Korea anyway, so I'm used to it, in South Korea. So my name is Scott Kalb, and I got to know Josh, and we did a lot of work regarding long-term investment, actually a lot of the gentlemen here. When I served a term, I actually just completed a term working as the Chief Investment Officer and Deputy CEO of the Korea Investment Corporation, which is the sovereign wealth fund for Korea. So I had the honor of being, I believe, the only foreigner who's ever been asked to run a sovereign wealth fund. Usually senior government officials, local government officials are asked to run those. So it was a very unusual circumstance. And I'm certainly the only U.S. citizen who's ever run a sovereign wealth fund because we don't have one. The sovereign wealth fund world is a very interesting world. There's only about 40, maybe 45 today. There's some being formed. Really, 70% of them have just been formed within the last 10 years. So it's a fairly new phenomenon, but very, very powerful in financial circles. Those 40 funds together control about $5 trillion. The KIC where I worked when I started, we started at about $20 billion, and when I left, we were at about $55 billion. And one of my jobs, it was only formed in 2005, so I came in and I was really the second CIO and deputy CEO there. And so my job really was to sort of try to move them forward, and one of the things that we did was to take them from zero to about 15% of assets in alternative strategies, including private equity plus a whole range, infrastructure, real estate, everything else.
Yeah. Pierre?
My name is Pierre Lavallée. I'm with the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, and just because of all this talk about sovereign wealth fund, I'll say right up front, we are not a sovereign wealth fund. We invest the surplus contributions to the Canada Pension Plan on behalf of 18 million beneficiaries. We manage in aggregate $165 billion, of which $20 billion is in the fund that I manage with a team of 30 people. Across our offices in Toronto, Hong Kong, and London. On top of the $20 billion that's already invested, we have another $13 billion that are unfunded commitments. And this is a program that is, as is the case for the overall fund, is a program that is destined to grow over time. Our investment mandate is to focus on returns and minimizing risks of loss, but it is a returns-based rather than economic policy-supporting type investment mandate.
Okay. Okay.
So my name is Giancarlo Mark. I founded a firm called Upwelling Capital Group last year. My profile fit very neatly into the presentation that was presented this morning. Age-wise, don't have any leverage yet. Haven't asked the banks yet. I think I know the answer, actually. Prior to starting Upwelling Capital, I worked for 12 years for the California Public Employees Retirement System, which today is about $230 billion of assets under management. In that period from 1999 to 2011, the total committed and invested capital in our private equity program grew from $10 billion to about $50 billion. We're globally diversified. We had venture capital, leveraged buyout credit, expansion capital, energy, sort of everything in the private capital area. Infrastructure was not something we technically did in our group. A new infrastructure group was brought in, and real estate was separate as well. So happy to be here.
Thanks. So maybe we should just begin by trying to understand what the perspectives of institutions today are on these asset classes. And particularly, we've highlighted both venture and growth equity as playing crucial roles in terms of enabling financing to take place. It's clearly not everything, but it's clearly very important roles. So for instance, in your seat at CPP, how do you think about areas like venture, growth, equity? Is this, I mean, you guys have a lot of money to play with, and how does that affect how you think about these kinds of asset classes as they come, as people come knocking on your door? Yeah.
Right. We do have a large mandate, and there are hundreds and hundreds of people that call on us every year. And while I have I think in the industry a relatively large team, we are still very capacity constrained. Mm-hmm. And so we really operate under two major constraints. One is the actually very large amount of capital. That's a constraint for us because it drives the quantum in which we have to invest, something I think you'd appreciate. And the other constraint is people, people to make good investment decisions. And therefore, we've established some basic ground rules on the funds that we'll look at. And one of those is that we invest only in funds that are raising $750 million or more. And you say, well, why would you want to do that? Part of the rationale, not the only element, but a big part of it is that when we deploy a team to make an investment decision, we want that decision to be significant in terms of funding, which means we want to write a check for about $150 million or more. And if you want to invest $150 million in a $300 million fund, the fund starts to look at you and say, well, this is nice this time around, but what if you don't like us so much and you decide to not come back the next time? It creates a gigantic hole for the fund. So there's a dynamic there between the LP and the GP around balancing how many and how large an investor they want in their base versus what we're able to do in an efficient manner.
So that's 750, that's going to eliminate basically all but, what, 8 venture capital funds on the planet? And probably even if we were to go to, you know, sort of lower middle market buyout groups, they're gone. I mean, there's a lot of people you're not seeing as a result.
Right. That's true.
Yeah.
I mean, I think also, Josh, I'm just going to jump in here.
Yeah.
Sorry.
This is what it's all about.
As an asset allocator, venture capital is almost impossible to access if you're a large institution.
I thought there's all these people knocking on his door.
What happens is that it's not, you get no scale by putting $10 million or $20 million into something. You're managing $100 billion or $50 billion, and it just doesn't help. You don't have the resources to manage the small things. You can't get economies of scale. The other thing I just wanted to point out is that actually I think venture capital has a lot of proving of itself to do to investors. The returns have not been good. Mm-hmm. This is where we got to start. As an asset class, over the last 15 years, if you look at the Preqin data, the average annual return for venture capital has been 2.1%.
Right.
And so the standard deviation has been 54%.
Right. So as long as you look over the last 30 years, venture capital looks pretty good. It's just this minor inconvenience thing of the last decade that.
Well, no, this is 15 years. But I have to tell you that during the last decade, it was negative almost every year. So a lot of guys are, there's a very few people who have been able to have, you know, those big 100-fold hits. But for the most part, it's been a very disappointing asset class.
Eric, you know, you got a lot of VC skeptics going on here. Is Ford, have you been the same way? You're just sort of hiding under, you say, that was 1970s, we're out of it now? How do you think about that?
No, I think that's a very good question, Josh. And in general, I completely share that skepticism about the venture capital business as a whole. It's a terrible business and always has been. And it's particularly terrible today because it's become a completely winner-take-all kind of game. We work with 8 venture capital firms at this point in time, and virtually our entire venture capital portfolio, which is a $1 billion portfolio, is invested with those 8 firms, 4 of which we were the founding investor in, which include firms like Sequoia Capital, Matrix, Benchmark Capital. But they're firms that we were able to be there on the ground floor and grow with them. We've had a reasonably good success in that part of our portfolio, but there are a lot of problems that even those firms have to deal with today, some of which Jay referred to in his remarks and that I think are problematic. The IPO market is essentially closed to technology companies for a lot of the reasons that Jay described, but also I believe because there's a demand side problem. It's just not clear to me that the public markets want anything to do with technology in general. Tech stocks are trading at 30-year lows relative to industrial companies, and I think there's a general distaste for tech-related IPOs. That's a problem for the venture business because the enterprise values on IPO, on average, are multiples of the enterprise values on M&A or trade sale exits. And, of course, if you don't have an IPO exit option, a potential buyer like the Oracles of the world, which we referred to earlier, know that, and they're going to pay a much, much lower price for your company than they otherwise would if they know that you could threaten them by filing an S-1 and going public. So there are a number of problems that we, you know, are wrestling with, but at the same time, I would say that the issues with the IPO market have created an opportunity for the survivors in the venture business to capture a lot of the returns that used to be captured by public market investors by financing companies for a much longer period of time and being able to capture a larger portion of their growth trajectory, as it were, in successful companies. But in the end, it is unlikely that that's going to help most of the venture business below the top tier because from our perspective, the industry appears to be becoming even more and more of a winner-take-all dynamic in which if you're in that sort of top tier, however you define it, you have the ability to raise almost unlimited amounts of capital. If you're not, capital is essentially unavailable for the sorts of other firms, of which there are hundreds of them around, that used to be very active in the business.
So, I think the venture capital, in a way, is kind of reverting to its roots a little bit, which was that people starting up businesses would go to their family or friends or, you know, what we call angel investors to help get start up their businesses and then if they prosper, then they can go for another round of finance with maybe on a larger scale.
Yeah.
I think there was a period of time where we had this huge excess, almost like a bubble, where we started to see people getting involved, institutions getting involved. There was an opportunity to get involved in that early stage on a scale, but there was a little bit of a mania. Mm-hmm. And I think that's gone, and we're going back to this again, this war type of family and friends type of structure. And that's tough for large institutional asset allocators.
To play it. But let's put venture on this side in this little penalty box for the moment and think about the, you know, what we heard about in this panel before about middle market, particularly lower middle market firms. And, you know, we sort of saw, you know, the sort of case study of saying, here's a case of a firm which really needed financing, where the public markets weren't really viable, where, you know, bank didn't seem like the right fit, and where ultimately the decision was made to sort of go and get, you know, a sort of long-term private equity investor, maybe we'll call it medium-term private equity investor, because ultimately they need to get out to do that. But, you know, essentially Frontenac doesn't have a huge, I mean, they're not KKR in terms of having many, many, many billions of dollars under management. Yet we certainly hear from, you know, CPP, and I think we could hear this a lot more generally in terms of institutions saying we can't have too many relationships all these things. So we have to sort of set the bar pretty high in terms of fund. First of all, is that what you're hearing from pension funds more generally, saying limiting number of relationships?
It's not even pension funds. It's endowments. It's foundations. Everyone was kind of in a feeding frenzy in the last 10 years. And I think people are looking at their portfolio and they're saying a very well-known endowment, for instance, I talked to has 80 relationships. I said 15 matter. 15 matter, and they're trying to consolidate them. But I'm a California guy, so I'm going to be the voice of optimism here in venture capital. After that last panel, I went outside and I wrote down a few names for you all because I didn't want everyone thinking it's all about pets.com and that's venture capital. Has anyone ever heard of Jamba Juice? Has anyone ever heard of Square, a little thing you plug into your smartphone? That's a venture-backed company doing exceptionally well. Has anyone ever heard of Zumba Fitness, Miami, Florida? Has anyone ever heard of Under Armour, local company, right? Third-string quarterback from University of Maryland. So there are a lot of Noodles and Company in Denver, Colorado. These are just a handful. I thought of some companies I know of that are venture-backed or growth-backed companies. So there was a little company in Redmond, Washington, and another one in Austin, Texas you might have heard of called Dell and Microsoft as well. Everyone knows about HP and Google and Cisco and Intel. So, yes, I guess what I would say is, unfortunately, institutional capital has a tendency of following kind of a lemming mentality. Mm-hmm. And I think what you saw and you could see through a lot of the big pension funds, late 90s, tremendous capital is being made by those early investors, Eric, in the 90s throughout with the venture portfolio. So we all jumped in. And at one point in time, CalPERS venture capital portfolio was 25% of the entire portfolio. Now, the portfolio is much smaller in total dollars. We were just chasing. We were looking for that venture, elusive venture return. And in our minds, we were 100 miles away from Silicon Valley. Why can't we have a great venture portfolio? The returns weren't very good. But, a lesson in life, whenever money is too easy to come by, bad things happen. That's kind of what happened with venture capital. You had too much money pouring into the asset class and not the same discipline that made venture work very well when Eric was and his foundation backing the $100 million, $200 million early stage or seed stage venture funds. There was real discipline put on the entrepreneurs. It wasn't like they were doing, $20 million capital injections in the first round. They were slowly putting the money to work in those companies and having the company management meet milestones, that kind of went away. I think we're coming back to that. So I think that, returns have not been great. It's funny because I also went and checked on some returns in the break, and I looked at State Street does an index through March, so it's not totally current, but the 10-year return was 6.2%, so actually better than the public markets. The one-year return and the three-year return are about 14%. So, it's okay. It's coming back. And I think what you have is much like other parts of the investment universe, there's a compression going on in venture capital as well. And probably what has to happen is the big guys got to stay out of it, like CalPERS and CPP, and the smaller institutions where it matters in a $5 or $10 or $20 million commitment to an early stage venture capital drives the needle, moves the needle for them, and is a valuable and valid investment.
Now, one of the issues that came up in the earlier panel had to do with this notion of alignment of incentives and all that. And particularly, there was a sense of saying, look, we all make money at the same time. Your friendly private equity or venture capitalist is only going to really be making money if the entrepreneurs is making money and the investor is making money. But it seems clear there's been, a bit of static, I guess would be the kind word to put it, in terms of the relationship between the people with the money on the one hand and the people investing the money, between the limited partners, the people here, and the general partners who are actually running the fund. How do you make sense of what's going on with that, Eric?
I think it comes down to supply and demand in the particular market that you're looking at. So in the buyout market or private equity market, on the one hand, there's a lot less differentiation, in my view, amongst a lot of the firms that are seeking capital. And there was a plentiful supply of capital in the last 10 years, which led to the consistent ratcheting of terms against investors. That seems to be reversing now. And most importantly, around
in my view, around deal fees or transaction fees, which came to comprise a very large portion of the income of the general partners of a lot of the larger firms and really served to misalign interests between general partners and limited partners. As I see as an observer or spectator at the largest end of the market where we don't tend to participate, that does seem to be correcting itself. In the venture business, there is overcapacity as well, but the rationalization of supply and demand seems to be happening not through a ratcheting of terms in favor of limited partners, but rather through this kind of Darwinian winnowing process that I described earlier, that is a reduction in the supply of venture capital firms, so that the small core of perceived top-tier firms will continue to have huge leverage vis-a-vis prospective investors. And in my view, it will be likely to remain a seller's market, so that investors like me will continue to face what I call a Groucho Marx problem, namely, you probably don't want to invest in any venture capital firm whose terms you could rewrite to your liking. And so I think that it just depends on which market you're looking at, and each of these things is sorting itself out in a different way.
Yeah. So I think it's sort of important to get back and understand, you know, what everybody's role is, and sometimes it gets forgotten. You know, the guys up here, you know, all are or have been, we're stewards of public capital. They're managing money on behalf of, you know, moms and pops pensions or their education or retirement benefits, and that's their job, is make that return. And historically, as an asset allocator, we used to have this old model. I think it's a, 60, 70-year-old model. It was the 60-40 model, which is you put 60% of your money into equities, you put 40% of your money into fixed income, into bonds, basically, and you run it, and that works, and that's how you, you know, you'll generate a return. And then maybe 20 years ago, people realized, well, you know, there's other asset classes out there that are developing, that are interesting. And one of the important things about a portfolio is you got to diversify. You know, you want to try to have uncorrelated return streams so that your portfolio's always got something working for it, and that you can get a overall, get the direction right, and get a nice risk-adjusted return. So asset allocators created this other bucket called other for alternatives. And for a while, that was the model, equity, fixed income, and other. And then gradually now the new trend has been, well, let's disaggregate this and let's start to make an asset allocation model that fully reflects what the risks are of these assets and what their return purposes are. So guys now are putting all sorts of equity together. They got public equity and private equity and other equity type of assets and so on. So the private equity industry developed in response to two things. One, a need for capital from companies or people that they could fill a need, and then also a demand from the investment community, especially from the asset allocators who want to diversify their portfolios. They want to get diversified return. Yeah. Well, you want to access, if you have the capacity to be a long-term investor, and as you got a big part of your portfolio which doesn't have to be liquid, then you want to try to invest in illiquid assets where you can generate a premium return. Why you should, and it can also be uncorrelated and diversified. So the private equity industry developed really as intermediaries in that field. They're taking capital from asset allocators and investing it also where there's a demand, and they're making a return. But I think that sometimes people have forgotten. You know, they think that that the reason why the private equity industry exists is so that, you know, they can make a nice living. Well, it's okay, you can make a nice living, but that's not why the industry exists. The industry exists to help, really, I think ultimately, help the asset allocators generate a better diversified return on behalf of the moms and pops who are managing that money. And I think that's the job of the private equity guys, and they also then have to manage the companies. But I think that's really what it's about. And venture capital is a little different because usually the demands, you know, that the large capital, institutional capital, and the asset allocators would overwhelm them So it's a little different. And, you know, maybe if they aggregated it together and they could intermediate. So, you know, my view is that sometimes, so we, for to us, private equity managers, these intermediaries are very, very important, but they also, you know, to us, and because we want to access that asset class, we can't do it all ourselves. We need good good partners. But it's very important to me that they also behave well and remember kind of what their role is. Their role is to really work with the asset allocators who are trying to get those returns, you know, and improve the risk-adjusted profile of returns for their moms and pops.
But ultimately in that, part of the question is, so what is fair compensation for them to do that, right? And when you have market imbalances where too much capital is chasing too few managers, then those managers can set the conditions under which they work, which includes the fees you hear about, the deal fees they used to take, and all of these things. And over the last maybe 5-6 years, that balance is shifting. And so that even, you know, you will have some winnowing out, but those that remain, I'd say that they're averaging down in what they think they need to operate. You know, and a lot of them don't need the kind of money they were making in 03, 04. They're finding a way to make do with what is still outstanding compensation, I think, by any frame of reference. And that's part of the swing that's happening now, I think, that we're seeing.
So, Pierre, what I'm hearing you saying is that this is really sort of not just a short-run blip, but a really more permanent shift. But even so, you're not really necessarily – we don't need to necessarily – have too many sleepless nights worrying about the compensation of the private equity guys?
Easy to agree with the last part of your statement, but I'm not sure about the permanence of it.
Right.
This is a cyclical business. It's gone through, it was very small in the mid-90s when I started being involved with it, and it's gone in cycles like this in terms of its overall growth. And now that, you know, the question is, will it actually come down in size? I haven't seen that yet, frankly, but will it be a permanent shift, or is it just temporary as we're about to go into another cycle like this? I think what we're seeing is a little bit of polarization in that, whereas, you know, if I've described the averages moving down in terms of how much the GP's keeping, there's still some premium folks out there that are working on terms that you would think as being outrageous. That being said, they can do it, and they'll be able to continue to do it if they continue to provide the returns that Scott was talking about before, right? Because ultimately, we will continue to invest in those or through those GPs if they continue to provide above benchmark returns.
Josh, I think there's a bigger issue here, and actually Professor Ritter just talked about the fact that IPOs historically 10, 20 years ago have not really done well. And I think the bigger issue is private equity has sort of replaced a part of the public markets, because these companies are less mature and probably not appropriate for a $20 million company to go public. You know, you had a different kind of a research and investment banking ecosystem 15 years ago, pumping these companies. And then, of course, when they'd go public, they were distracted by the quarterly earnings and whatnot. And private equity really should bring more than capital. So in a lot of ways, they should be there to provide guidance to help these companies become more competitive, stronger. Focus, shareholder concentration, so focus, because they only make money when they create value by the company doing well. So I think that's the bigger picture. Things like the fees, is unfortunately, that was a supply and demand issue. But I think the other thing is, with all these companies going public these days, and with the presidential candidate coming from private equity, I think there's a hell of a lot more focus now on kind of how it all works. And I think that a lot of that is, I mean, it's still, if someone's generating great returns, they're going to get paid premium economics, sort of the New York Yankees dilemma, right? But if they can generate good returns, investors will continue to commit capital to them. But I think that the big picture is private equity is, and not just here in the States, you know, this is a private equity has become very global. It's different in Asia. It's different in Europe. But it's a very global, permanent part of the overall investment landscape.
I also think I think the investment community, institutional investment community, is becoming more sophisticated, more mature. The asset class has been around longer. People have been involved. And as they become more mature now, I think that the shape of the industry is changing. I think investors are looking more for partnerships, not just – You know, here's my money, you know, and take what you want and just
so
my
this
return.
Is all pretty rosy, but I guess, Scott, what's worrying me is saying, you know, we know that, I mean, this was alluded to earlier today, there's a lot of interest on the part of governments, not just in the United States with the Dodd-Frank, but also in Europe with the AIFM and so forth, interested in sort of regulating this stuff, saying this has been a big unregulated, an increasingly big unregulated market. Is this going to mess it all up, or is somehow, you know, regulators are actually going to make things better here?
So regulation is a really it's a really complex topic. You know, we've seen recently, you know, we have Dodd-Frank in the U.S., we had the AIFM directive in Europe, these are all sort of geared towards trying to regulate all alternatives, but let's focus on private equity. And it's very confusing because the regulators essentially what they've said is we're very interested in, one, preventing systemic risk and also making sure that we can kind of prevent contagion. And so we want to extend regulation to, you know, we want to put in regulation on the banking system, fine. But we also want to extend this to unregulated financial entities like private equity. The problem is that, you know, as they have pointed out in their directives or in their regulations, that private equity really wasn't involved in causing contagion or systemic risk. But nevertheless, it's confusing because they want to extend regulations to them. And what we're worried about as investors is, you know, what are the unintended consequences? You know, so as a result of some of these regulations, we may have restricted access to private equity managers. Our costs may go up. Our returns may go down. We may, you know, we're seeing that some U.S. Firms may not be able to operate in Europe. Some European firms may not be able to operate in the U.S. I mean, this is kind of a mess. And one of the other things I don't really understand is why haven't the regulators reached out to the asset allocating, you know, or the public asset allocation community or foundations who are the stewards of capital who want to access this asset class in an intelligent way? And why aren't they reaching out to them to get their views and to find out, you know, how we can make regulation? Nobody's going to object to regulation that gets the bad guys. You know, and there's a lot of bad guys out there. So, okay, let's get the bad guys. Everybody agrees. But you want to also try to make sure that you encourage good behavior and so that you have good actors out there and that we can access them so that we can get, you know, better returns again for our risk-adjusted returns for our constituents.
All right. We've got around 10 minutes left, and I can certainly pepper these guys with questions for the next 2 hours. But I think I'd be interested in hearing some comments, and I see there's a question already.
Excuse me. We've heard a lot about, I've heard it twice anyway today, unintended consequences of regulation. Maybe, but we know what the consequences are when lax regulation is out there. When there are billions and trillions of dollars at stake, our best angels don't come forward. But that's not my question. Talked about a lot of passive investing on the part of these entities. But there's a lot of active investing that's going on, too. It's my understanding that private equity is the rebranded form of leveraged buyouts from the 1980s, and we know where that took us. I guess my question is there any social conscience? I use this all the time. Is there any social conscience to this money?
Right.
You want to cut me short?
No.
No.
I think we got it, but let's hear the end of it. Yeah.
Okay. No. When we look at this, like
right.
Bain brought this to the fore in the last
right.
election. All right. You know, is there a need to go in there and tear apart a company and right. possibly send jobs right. overseas when we need them here? I don't know. I'm just.
Yeah. It's a great question, and I mean, I think you can see this especially in Europe, where, you know, one of the aspects of the AIFM, which has not really dealt so much with systematic regulation, has been in terms of saying, here's a bunch of bad behavior by private equity guys we want to eliminate. So one of the clauses, the sort of, I think it's Article 20, is the one which sort of deals with quick flips. And it basically says, you will not go in,
buy a company and sell it more, you know, within 18 months later. You will not do special dividends and various other things. And I guess it's an appropriate question to ask, is saying, is that, you know, if we, I mean, I think we all accept the fact that, you know, private equity is not entirely consist of angels, and that there are groups who have done some very good long-term things, and there's some groups who have behaved in extremely short-run manners, and which have been problematic. Is essentially a regulation like that the way to address these kinds of problems? Nobody wants to take that one.
Well, I mean, do you think a public equity manager is restricted from selling their stock within 18 months?
Right. So you say there's lots of short-term behavior everywhere.
The gentleman from Frontenac this morning talked about it. He said integrity is really key. As an investor, mm-hmm. I assure you we spend a lot of time doing the due diligence on the managers themselves, their backgrounds, even their mm-hmm. personal lives, to understand what are these people like. Because at the end of the day, they've got to sell themselves to an entrepreneur who's got to say, this is my partner, mm-hmm. and they've got to know that that's the one they can count on. Mm-hmm. So, again, no doubt there are bad actors in this industry, mm-hmm. but I think integrity has a lot to do because, you know, bad news travels 25 times faster than good news. And if you develop that kind of a reputation, mm-hmm. you're not going to get the good deals, and you're not going to get the returns for the investors. So I think there's, you know, the leverage question is an issue. You want to commit capital to managers who prudently use leverage, not the kind of leverage that was maybe used 25 years ago. But some people have short memories, right? But, you know, the funny thing is that we hear about, you know, jobs being lost and jobs being sent overseas. It happens all the time in corporate America, mm-hmm. you know, all the time, right? HP in my backyard laid off 5,000 people, 10,000 people. And so it's just sort of, I think it's how do you make a company more efficient in a way that at the end of the day makes a company more competitive so that can create shareholder value for the long term, whether you're a public company or a private equity-backed company. Mm.
I just want to say also, I think what you're seeing is a growing trend. This may not be a complete response, but we're seeing a growing trend of disintermediation taking place. Mm-hmm. And that is that as the asset allocators, or the large ones anyway, getting more and more sophisticated, they're not happy with the providers in terms of their mm-hmm. the GPs, if they're doing not doing a great job, or they're charging too much money, or they're too short term. You mean, for us, for example, you know, I don't think when I was at KS, I don't think we ever sold a position, a stock. I mean, not short term. What's happening is the guys are starting to do more themselves directly. And I think you'll see that going on. So to a certain extent, that will force better behavior. The market itself will start to force better behavior, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right. There are about 8 hands up. So why don't we start with gentleman over there.
Thank you. I have a question on the issue of capital scarcity for the middle market fund managers. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, since all of you have been stewards of large pools of capital, what your view is on funds of funds of accessing some of these smaller fund managers.
Right. So maybe we should start with Giancarlo. Just CalPERS did a bunch of things along these lines, right, to try to say, you can talk about it more clearly than I can.
Well, I think you're seeing a kind of fund of funds have a little bit of a bad rap right now. Generally, the returns have not been outstanding, and the perception of this extra layer of fees that Scott was talking about, institutions trying to disintermediate. But I think the reality is, as they're concentrating on the bigger end of the market, they might find out that just because they're able to cut management fees by 25 basis points, their net return may not be great, and they may be missing something in the middle market. So, you know, on the other hand, there are smaller institutions that are happy to do funds. In fact, many of those institutions say, once a fund exceeds $1 billion or $2 billion, we're not going to commit to it because we don't believe in that part of the market. But I think the fund of funds have definitely felt the squeeze recently. But some people say fund of funds are dead. I personally don't believe that because it takes a certain expertise to be able to source smaller funds, smaller than even $500 million. I think that's kind of the sweet spot where people just don't have the resources to do that. But then again, you have to be the right size, because if you commit $100 or $200 million to a fund of funds, it's going to give you 30 new relationships. It may not be that valuable.
I think they can be the right answer. It's the market segments, like any business probably segments itself, and I think they have a role to play with a very defined segment.
Early on, we've only started to invest actively at CPPIB in the last 10 years, and really only since 2005. But in the early days, we actually had a number of fund-to-fund relationships. And what we found is what you described, which is that, and this could be, I wasn't there, so easy for me to say, but I think if a fund of funds is trying to go too broadly, and a lot of them have, you know, dozens and dozens of relationships within the fund, they end up averaging out to average performance.
Yep.
Well, the simple math, we talked about incentives earlier, simple math is at average performance, I don't get paid. So I have no interest. Mm-hmm. And my team has no interest. And so what you'll see, if you look at our portfolio, which is publicly disclosed, you'll see some fund-to-fund relationships. But the reality is in the last 5 or 6 years, I don't think we've renewed any of them save for one, which is a Canadian fund of funds, where the role they can play for us is absolutely leveraging their existing business, and they're able to provide to us a service investing in Canadian funds at a cost structure that we can't replicate. And to me, that's a segmented, sort of very specific, it works for us, may not work for, frankly, any other fund on this panel, but for us it actually works very well.
Over here.
It's always easier to talk about the misaligned incentives of others. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about one that should be the partners in many of your deals, which are the banks, and which have over the last two decades basically been given misaligned incentives in the same mm-hmm. way that they're allowed to earn much higher risk-adjusted return mm-hmm. when investing in something safe than when investing in something risky. These banks, have they changed the way they cooperate in the whole process over the years? How are these regulations affecting you in a direct form in your day-to-day activities with startup companies, in the private equity investment process, or are they just absent completely?
Now, I think this is a really interesting question, right? Because certainly there's been a lot of research which suggests that, you know, one of the reasons why the private equity industry has been so crazy, where there's these periods with a huge amount of funding of buyouts and then periods where there's relatively little funding, has been because either the banks have this, bankers seem to have this on-off switch where they're either shoveling huge amounts of money at anyone who walks in the door or else, you know, refusing anybody who comes along. And so in a way, whether we like them or not, you know, if you're doing private equity investing, you're sort of married to the banking sector. So what are you seeing there?
I would just caution that it's important not to confine the analysis just to the banks, because the high yield market mm-hmm. and the bond markets are over time going to become much, much more important players in terms of the scale of finance they're providing. And there's really essentially no regulation on the terms of the way in which that financing gets provided. So now, again, we're seeing terms in high yield right. coming right back to where they were in 2007 with all the bells and whistles.
So you say that regulation is sort of clamping down on the banks, and it's just like instead it's popping up here in the sort of junk bond market where there's even less regulation than there was originally in the...
And you're starting to see that in Europe, which before about 5 years ago had essentially no junk bond financing market for leveraged buyouts. Now that's starting to take over from what the banks were doing, and it's on much easier terms than bank loans would typically be made available.
So interesting statistic is if you looked at all the different kinds of... there's lots of different kinds of private equity funds, but one of the best asset classes over the last 15 years has actually been mezzanine debt, which is a function of, I think, disintermediating the banks, if you will. So it shows that there's some premium they've been capturing, which is now available and which will start to be compressed. But mezzanine finance had a high single-digit return average per annum over the last 15 years with only a 12% standard deviation. So pretty good. So I think the banks will... they're either going to have to do it well or they're going to gradually be pushed aside because there's other capital. You know, from here, for example, you know, we will provide
finance, mezzanine finance, or credit to companies.
All right. Well, I could keep peppering these guys for a while, and I think there's at least the five of us would be quite fascinated with it. I think we have to be sensitive to the time, keeping the trains running on time. And just as a reminder, we're doing something a little funky, which is to say we're having a break of 30 minutes, but the idea is that we're going to have the abundance of absolutely gourmet sandwiches that Martin's been whipping up during the last hour. And then we will reconvene to sort of deal with, one, the sort of great issue which we've not really touched on before, the sort of area of crowdfunding and whether it's indeed the solution to our problems of financing availability. And then we will have Congressman Himes to sort of give a little bit of a broader perspective from someone who has bridged both the private financial world and the public sector. So let me just end my piece by thanking all panelists for your fascinating.
I misspoke earlier. They're not actually box lunches. It's a sandwich spread that's laid out there. So you have to do what your mother told you not to do, which is eat quickly and also sort of grab quickly. So we need to fit everybody in. So
if we think about this morning as having dealt with the past, our last two events are really dealing with the future. And we're going to start with what may in some sense be one of the funkiest aspects of a Jobs Act, which has been the sort of real interest in terms of crowdfunding and the efforts to try to facilitate crowdfunding. And we have fortunate in our to talk to us Ajay Agrawal. He's interesting for two reasons. One, of course, is that he's been one of the luminaries in terms of looking at the intersection of entrepreneurial finance and strategy, and done a whole variety of interesting work in terms of the regionalization of entrepreneurship and a variety of other extremely interesting areas. He's also been very involved at the Rotman School, where he is the Peter Monk Professor of Entrepreneurship, in terms of not just simply the theory, but trying to turn Toronto into an entrepreneurial hub with various efforts to incubate and nurture the best ideals that are out there. And I think perhaps making him particularly well qualified for this, he is also about the sole academic who has looked seriously at crowdfunding as a phenomenon, and as a result can really tell us whether this is the salvation or not for our entrepreneurial finance woes. So without further ado, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Thanks for the invitation, Martin and Josh, for inviting me to participate. I noticed the title in the program of this session was Crowdfunding the New Frontier. Maybe that was to make it enticing to come back after a 30-minute lunch. It could have been Crowdfunding the Controversial Frontier. Just so I have a sense, how many people feel they have a reasonably good idea what crowdfunding is? Okay, most people. And also, how many people here have participated in some form of crowdfunding? Okay, so maybe 20% or so. All right, so then rather than walking through the mechanics of what crowdfunding is, for those of you who don't have as much idea, I will explain it by way of a story. So this is a story that many of you know, and it begins with a Canadian. So on April the 11th, 2012, Eric Mijakovsky launched a crowdfunding campaign to raise capital to produce an invention that he had created called the Pebble Watch. So who is Eric? He's from Vancouver. He's a graduate of the Waterloo, a university in Ontario. He was at the time at Y Combinator, a high-profile software incubator in Silicon Valley, living in Palo Alto. He had created a watch before this called the Impulse, which interfaced with a BlackBerry, and now he had founded the Pebble. So what was the Pebble? Or what is the Pebble? or what might the pebble be? So the pebble is essentially, so a simple way to think of it is it's a watch that allows you to interface with your iPhone, because there are many, or your Android device. Many times when you're doing things like riding your bike or golfing or whatever, running, where you might want to interface with your device, and it's not convenient to actually have your device in your hand. And so his idea was that you would have a screen on your wrist, and you could interact, so you could control your music, you could pull up emails, get messages, and so on the screen on your watch. And it would communicate with the CPU in your device through Bluetooth. Okay, so that was the idea. So why did he need capital? He needed capital because he had designed the watch. He had even built a couple of prototypes of the watch. But now he needed the machinery to actually build a watch even at a small scale. So production tooling, large component orders for all the parts that make up the watch, and Bluetooth certification. It's useful in this example to remind ourselves, who was he? In other words, was he a novice that no one had ever heard of before? Not exactly. He had already built the Impulse. He had, for that, raised money from well-known angel investors and early-stage investors, including Tim Draper of DFJ and one of the partners at Y Combinator. And yet, when he went out with the Pebble to raise just $100,000 for this tooling, he couldn't get it. And when he was interviewed by the Los Angeles Times, he said, hardware is much harder to raise money for. We were hoping we could convince some people to our vision, but it didn't work out. Even somebody with his track record. So what did he do? He ended up putting this watch onto Kickstarter, one of these crowdfunding platforms, and where essentially you can offer rewards for people to back your project. And so in his case, he had a list of rewards that were basically, he would reward you with a copy, with one of his watches once he built them. So what happened? He launched his campaign on April 11th, so roughly a week after President Obama signed the Jobs Act. And he set a target that he wanted to raise $100,000 so he could get some of this tooling equipment. He raised that $100,000 in the first 2 hours. He went to sleep that night and woke up in the morning and had over $1 million. He ran his campaign for 37 days, at which time, when that campaign closed, he had over $10 million. He had almost 70,000 people who were supporting the building of the Pebble Watch, and he had now made a commitment to deliver 85,000 watches. This was what he had promised on the site, and we'll speak to the dark side of crowdfunding. The dark side of a good entrepreneur is that he would deliver his watches by September. This is something he posted on his website a few weeks ago. DVPVMP, I'm heading to our factory in Nongguan, China on Saturday for 2 weeks of work on the design verification test build. After DV, we have one more test build scheduled in December called production verification before Pebble enters mass production. As I mentioned in update number 17, this was update number 26 or something, our assembly line will be set up to manufacture 15,000 Pebble watches per week. I know each one of you has a burning desire to see Pebble on their wrist, but I want to caution you that even after we begin mass production, it will still take us several weeks to manufacture all 85,000 Pebbles. Okay, and this was written on November 10th. Keep in mind that he had promised his watches for September. And then he sends a variety of other messages. And the reason this is so important, I think, is it gives a sense of the uncertainty facing the entrepreneur when they raise money and the way that they have to communicate with, in this case, not their angel or venture capital investor, but the community of investors on the crowdfunding platform. He writes, we have confirmation from our primary component supplier that the vast majority of components have departed Arizona. They're flying towards Hong Kong and ultimately Dongguan, China. There are more than 110 electronic components inside each Pebble. It's been a lot of fun finding 85,000 sets of everything, he writes in October of 2012. And then again, a few weeks ago, he explains to his investors how he's trying to accelerate things. And here he's practicing mailing them things. He says, while we're not ready to start shipping out our Pebbles yet, getting prepared to ship to 113 different countries has been quite a task. okay, just one of you lives in French Polynesia, but we care deeply about all our backers. That's why we've been running extensive shipping tests to determine the best methods to use as we ship out 85,000 pebbles. All the test shipments reach their destination. Outside of a postal strike in Uruguay, we found that our test shipments reached their destination even faster than we expected. We also learned some important lessons about all the different customs documentation required around the world. This is the entrepreneur for the first time shipping his product internationally. And he posts on his on the platform, on the crowdfunding platform, pictures to keep his investors informed or his backers informed of the progress that he's making with the product. Okay, so why is crowdfunding interesting? There is certainly a lot of interest in it. This is a schematic of Google search volume on the term crowdfunding. Now, the first real crowdfunding platform, the one that gained international recognition for some time was the major crowdfunding platform in the world, was for music. It's called Celeban. It launched in August 2006. I began collecting data on crowdfunding just after that launch. Kickstarter, which is now the dominant crowdfunding platform for non-lending-based crowdfunding, launched in April 2009, right here. SEC Chairman Mary Shapiro made a remark that was quoted in the Wall Street Journal on April 11th. They were discussing crowdfunding as possible regulatory approaches. The first draft of the Jobs Act passes the House in November of 2011. President Obama signs the Jobs Act in April 2012. In other words, there has been a lot of the interest in crowdfunding. I know this because I tried publishing a paper in the early part. Was very limited. The recent interest in crowdfunding, as you can see, has surged. Okay, but why is it interesting here in Washington? I think it's interesting because there is an assumption that underlines the reason for addressing crowdfunding in the Jobs Act that allowing or facilitating or promoting crowdfunding will in some way increase the flow of capital into early stage ventures, into supporting entrepreneurs and launching new ventures. In other words, we can think about crowdfunding on at least two very basic dimensions. One is crowdfunding might add more capital into that early stage, into those early stage classes. So simply more capital. And by thinking of more, we can think of it as the following. Imagine that we ranked all of the investment opportunities by their risk-adjusted rate of return. So we had the very best ones at the top, and then we just worked our way down. And so assuming that capital markets work efficiently, that let's say that with the current capital in the market focused on that class, that we could finance the best 100 ventures. If we simply add more capital, then we might be able to finance, the next 10. In other words, at the margin, we're just going down the list and financing some more ventures. So that's if we think of crowdfunding as simply just adding more capital to that early stage class. There's also the possibility that crowdfunding might be different. That is to say, not only may it be working its way down, it may also be financing a different type of venture. And if you read the popular press, and here are the politicians, including President Obama, speaking on this topic when it's mentioned, the underlying assertion is that crowdfunding will operate largely in the bottom quadrant. In other words, it's going to add more capital, and it's going to add different capital. Different types of ventures that might not otherwise get funded will get funded. Okay, so I think that the most useful way of framing our thinking as we are heading into this unknown territory of equity crowdfunding is, does crowdfunding influence the rate and direction of inventive and entrepreneurial activity? Does it fund projects or companies that would not otherwise be funded? So in other words, I think that's the basic question we should have in the back of our minds as we try and work our way through thinking about what crowdfunding does. Now, going to the issue of different, why might crowdfunding result in a different type of financing? In other words, financing different countries, not just more, not just going down the list, but different ones than otherwise. There are a few reasons. One is that the crowdfunding community, as they call themselves, may be operating with different sets of information. So in other words, one thing we know about traditional forms of early stage capital, namely angels and VCs, and family and friends, is that it is remarkably localized. And so investment decisions are being made based on local information. And the so-called wisdom of crowds that is facilitated by an online platform may change the information set and therefore result in different types of investments. The social platform, the fact that you can learn about who else has invested the moment they invest, because their profiles are right there on the platform, may change the nature of investment. Secondly, in addition to having different information, the people on these platforms may have different preferences. In other words, in addition to some people being completely motivated by risk-adjusted returns, there may be other investments. So for other motivations for investment. So for example, when you read some of the discussion going back and forth regarding the investors or the back, what they call backers of the Pebble Watch, these were people who wanted to support the venture because they wanted to support the technology. They wanted the product. Some of them wanted the product because they wanted to build their own ventures, because the way that particular product was being built, it was creating a platform on your wrist that would have an open development platform, because they were also distributing the software, the SDK, the software development kit, so that people could write more applications to go on the watch. There's also maybe a different type of investment because there's a different rule set. And there's a variety of reasons for the rule set being important. So, for example, family and friends that may have previously invested in a more unstructured, informal way can now do it in a manner that's far more formal and structured. But I think the one that will be most interesting, and I'll get to in a few moments, is the notion of a provision point mechanism. That is to say, it's the idea that when there are multiple investors who are considering investing in a venture, but everyone else's decision is going to be contingent on the entrepreneur being able to raise some minimum threshold amount of, in this case, capital, equity-based capital, that nobody's investment is committed until the full target is reached. Okay. So heading into the data on crowdfunding, I think an interesting question is, in what ways is crowdfunding capital similar to traditional forms of capital, and in what ways is it different? Let me begin with some ways that it's similar. So I'm going to present some data based on the Kickstarter platform, since it is by far the largest crowdfunding platform that's not lending. So I've just plotted on here Kiva and Prosper, which are both lending-based platforms. And one of the prominent equity-based crowdfunding platform, which is in the UK, Crowdcube, that's in the press quite a bit because it's an example of an actual equity-based platform. You can see it's tiny compared to something like Kickstarter. Okay. If you thought that because the investors are so geographically spread out that maybe they would allocate their capital geographically much more, in a very different manner than the way capital is normally distributed, you might be surprised at this figure. This is comparing, so I've just taken out the projects that are arts-based projects from Kickstarter and plotted them against the geographic distribution of grants from the National Endowment of the Arts. And what you see is that there is a surprising correlation. In other words, the regions that are attracting the most amount of NEA grants are also attracting the most amount of crowdfunding in that sector. Maybe you're not surprised, but you say, well, of course, that's where the talent is, that's where the artists are, but it certainly doesn't feel like that there is a significantly different geographic pattern resulting from crowdfunding investment. This is VC investment. VC investment plotted against crowdfunding in tech sectors. And if I take out those Wyoming and North Dakota at the bottom, you see, again, the geographic distribution of crowdfunding in technology is not that dissimilar, even though the funders themselves may be very spread out, than VC investment. Okay, going back to David's excellent presentation this morning where he talked about home loans, the next thing we went to do was to see, well, is crowdfunding orthogonal, so unrelated to other forms of capital such as home loans? And so what we did is we looked to the housing price index, and we were interested in the movement in housing price index, the indices over the three-year period that we have data for crowdfunding. And so what we wanted to do here is the basic idea was that as home loans become, let's imagine that as house price, as the house price index rises, the access to home loan increases. And so what we're interested in is as home loans become easier to get, do regions that experience a bigger bump have a higher or lower disposition to raise capital via crowdfunding? And on the one hand, if we would think that they were orthogonal, meaning that they're unrelated, that we should find no relationship between the house price index and the amount of crowdfunding raised in a region. So this is all at the city level. We use city fixed effects. So basically, we're just looking at within city variation. And the punchline here, without getting into all the regression details, is that we find a reasonably strong relationship. In other words, that as home loans become easier to get, regions decrease the amount of people that are raising money through crowdfunding. And that the crowdfunding appears to be in the range, or the relationship between crowdfunding and home equity loans, or the HPI index volatility, is happening in the range where we would expect it to be, which is not very small, but nor is it very large at the north of a $500,000 range. Okay. We also looked at, at crowdfunding in the context of music. So this was Celaband, the company I mentioned earlier. What was interesting about Celaband is for a three-year window, they operated as something that was closer to equity-based crowdfunding, which is while they didn't give out equity, what they did was you could invest in, this was all focused on new artists, so brand new unsigned artists who were raising money to record an album. And when an artist successfully raised the amount of money that they needed, that the funds, the $50,000 is what they would raise, the funds would be used to produce an album. The album would then be sold through a variety of channels, both digital downloads, hard copy CDs, and so on. And the revenues would be distributed a third, a third, a third. A third would go to the artist, a third would go to the platform, Celaband, and a third would go to the investors on a pro rata basis based on how many shares they bought. When we discovered this, the reason I became so interested in this was I had spent some time earlier at the MIT Media Lab looking at the various technologies people are exploring to try and protect music from illegal sharing. And at the end of the day, one realizes when you're studying that, investigating that topic, there's no way to protect music. Because as soon as you can play it, you can record it. As soon as you can record it, you can then distribute it. So in other words, there seemed like there was no way you could ever protect music. When I came across Celaband, I realized I discovered the one and only type of music that can never be copied. And that was the music that had yet to be made. That was music that hadn't yet been made that people would pay for in advance of it being made through crowdfunding. Crowdfunding was interesting here because even though there were thousands and thousands of artists on the site, that the capital going into artists through the crowdfunding platform didn't look that different than the way it does in Los Angeles and Nashville. That is to say, it was wildly skewed. That the most of the capital went into a tiny fraction of artists. Even though we think of ourselves as having a great variety of musical tastes, that the crowdfunders, 2% of the projects accounted for 80% of the capital raised. Same thing, same thing at Kickstarter, not quite as skewed, but reasonably skewed, that the top 20% of projects account for 75% of the total capital raised on Kickstarter. Okay, so in other words, here, those are some ways in which crowdfunding capital is similar to some traditional forms of capital. It's got a similar geographic distribution, as I illustrated through those scatter plots. It's got some relationship to other forms of capital, like home equity loans, in the sense that there seems to be some substitution between those two. and it's got a similar degree of skewness. Now, in what ways is it different? I think to think about ways in which it might be different, it's first of all useful to keep in mind that we are talking about a moving target. This is the accumulated capital being put on Kickstarter, and I stopped collecting data in October of this year, and even in the last month, that line now would be way off my slide. And so it's a moving target. Secondly, this is the mean size of projects. As you can see, if I had given this talk in 2011, I would have said, look, the average size of a project is very small. It's $5,000, and that characterizes, you know, says something qualitative about projects on these that kind of a crowdfunding platform, and I would have misrepresented what was about to happen in the years afterwards, in just you know the quarter one of 2012, when essentially technology projects started making their way onto the platform. Okay, so the thing about crowdfunding that I think has been lost in the press is that, especially since Kickstarter is the dominant platform, is that Kickstarter, we discuss it in terms of statistics in the aggregate, and really it's like a Middle Eastern bazaar. There are all sorts of different types of things happening on this platform, and to understand the mechanics of crowdfunding, we have to take that apart and realize that some sectors are very different than others. So as you can see, first of all, there's four big sectors: design, film, games, and music. Design, by the way, is the category that Pebble Watch was in. Okay, and so Pebble Watch, design, and technology are reasonably similar. So the first thing is, like I say, that there's four big categories that account for the lion's share of activity on the platform, and then a bunch of others. Design and games, what we think of, you know, these are the types of projects that we feel similar to the things we think about when we think of Silicon Valley, are different in a variety of respects. The big thing you can see is the discontinuity in the amount of capital raised at various points in time. Those are big projects. It's like the Pebble Watch was a $10 million project. Whereas film and video and music are all as a series of small projects. The other thing is these have very different growth. I mean, who knows what this will look like if I were to give this talk 6 months from now, because it's changing so fast. But the point is that different sectors are growing at very different rates. Games is just going off the charts on the crowdfunding platforms. In terms of the investment size, that the total capital raise, you can see that the majority is going towards small projects that are less than $50,000 projects. However, that doesn't represent the distribution by sector. So essentially, the large projects are all happening in design, games, and technology. Geographically, probably as you suspect, the top regions in California and New York are top in almost every category, but you're probably not surprised to, for example, see Nashville, Tennessee is one of the top regions for music, and so on. I think, at least with the current type of crowdfunding platforms, one of the very interesting distinctions between crowdfunding and other forms of capital allocation is how explicit the ulterior motives, in addition to risk-adjusted returns, are on these crowdfunding sites. So, for example, people are putting a fair amount of capital in just to receive notifications of updates of the project. In other words, they want to feel part of the entrepreneur's community who's building this new product. So there are rewards in here where you get a T-shirt, you get thank you emails, you get a poster, and so on. It's not until you put in $275 do you get a promise of a reward for your contribution of a prototype of this device. So the composition of all the of the $2 million raised for these virtual reality goggles, a large fraction was essentially pre-selling. They offer a product in return for a pledge in advance, and then not insignificant amount, almost 10%. It's just sheer philanthropy. People who want to be part of that community buy merchandise and VIP access. So, you know, something they're going to get something early, earlier than the rest of the market. Okay. The last point I'm going to make here is on geography. So that is to say, one of the most interesting things about crowdfunding is that, unlike traditional forms of very early stage capital, which is known for being very local, that the geography of crowdfunding, there are people from around the world who are putting in small amounts into very early stage ventures. In this case, going back to the music data, that the average distance, keep in mind this is for an unknown artist that no one's, that has got no track record, the average distance between the artist and the investor was approximately 3,000 miles. So we looked at every transaction over a 3-year period on this platform, and these are the data. Now, why is this interesting? On all the platforms, and currently also in the Jobs Act, one of the key features of the crowdfunding platform is this provision point mechanism, which is to say you have to outline before you raise your capital how much capital you need, your target. And then as investors put their capital in, it sits in escrow until the entrepreneur successfully raises that amount of capital. And usually there's a time limit in terms of how long they have before they can raise the capital. If they don't raise the capital, by the time they hit the time limit, the money's returned to investors and all bets are off. What was interesting about, and they all have this, Kickstarter has it, Indiegogo has it, Kiva has it. What was interesting is that, probably not surprising, that as projects advanced through the process in terms of how much capital they'd raised, so keep in mind on this site they had to raise $50,000 to hit their target, that the probability of an investor investing in a given week increased substantially as they got closer to their goal. Okay, so this is based on regression analysis where we're looking at the artist-investor pair, and we're looking at the probability that an investor will make an investment in a given artist in a given week. And it increases significantly as the amount of capital raised increases. And this is true not just on this site, on all the sites that follow this type of pattern, all the major sites at least. Okay, so we then look and we split the investors up into two groups, those that were local and those that were distant. Local we call those that were within a 60-mile radius of the residence of the artist and those that were not. Okay, so the majority of investment, 87% of the investment, came from distant investors. So that's interesting. But what was more interesting was this, that the local investors were insensitive to how much had been raised. In other words, they weren't using the information of who else was investing and how much had been raised. They were making their decisions based on something else because they were local. So at first we thought this is a geography phenomenon. We said, you know what, this kind of capital perhaps isn't that different from traditional forms of capital, where locals are behaving differently than distant investors. But then we did something else. We coded up all the investors as being either friends and family or not, because some friends and family were local and some were distant. And what we found was that it was friends and family that were explaining that timing story. In other words, distant friends and family, local friends and family behaved the same. It didn't matter for them. They were investing irregardless of the timing of other investments. It was the non-friends and family who were waiting to see if other people would invest. And so what we realized was, even on a music-based crowdfunding platform, and now we started to find it on other platforms, that just like in the offline world, the non-crowdfunding world, that other investors want to make sure that the people who know you, at least they believe in you. At least they'll put their money behind your venture before they get in and start investing in your project. And so the online world has these offline-related frictions, in this case, social frictions. Okay, so let me conclude by saying that what I think we're going to be watching for as things unfold with crowdfunding is the extent to which crowdfunding investments are both more and different. To what extent are they resulting in financing more companies, but perhaps more interestingly, different companies, companies that wouldn't otherwise be financed. And I've just got some points on here on ways in which we think that difference might occur. That's it. Thanks very much. I'll take some questions.
Hi, two questions. One, can you just clarify on Kickstarter that it's actually not, people are not investing in a product. They are basically There's no actual legal investment.
Right. There's no investment. They are backing. They are backing a project.
Okay. Two. Have you considered or sort of realized, at least in game publishing, that you had like on one of the charts people are pre-ordering, where game publishers for years have really been pre-selling, where they put out a work that's not finished and then they gauge the response. And if it does well, they say, okay, we're going to support it. We're going to do additional content. And if it doesn't, then they basically move on to the next project. Even some extreme cases where they're willing to possibly alienate their customer base just to keep it going. So technically, it's not capital investment, but it's really a reverse way of doing it, and that definitely predates 2006. So I was kind of curious on your thoughts on that as well.
So yes. I mean, yes, in the sense that this was happening before. And perhaps one way to think about this is that crowdfunding seems to, at least one permutation of crowdfunding seems to have formalized the market for pre-selling ideas. And so, to the extent that, there is much of the entrepreneur community who has embraced the idea that has been popularized by Eric Ries and Steve Blank and some others of the lean startup methodology, and this is very consistent with lean in the sense that people aren't building something until they can see evidence of customers. So in the old days, we used to call that, market research and focus groups. And now we're saying, look, rather than you tell me in a focus group setting that you would buy this if I built it, instead, put your money where your mouth is. And so not only do you get to see a real sense of demand because the capital will be committed as soon as you hit your target, but perhaps even more interestingly, you get to do some pre-research on price discrimination because, for example, I don't know if you saw on the Pebble Watch menu, that there was a different price if you wanted it black versus colors, if you wanted 2 versus 5. And so there was a lot of pricing information that the entrepreneur was getting before he even built the product. Next question. Yes.
With regard to your study, you showed the example of the NEA, the monies, I'm assuming it were primarily nonprofits. Do you see the implication for states with more scrutiny and securing those dollars from the nonprofits from a solicitation standpoint? And number two, with regard to intellectual property, do you see any implications, whether positive or negative, for those entrepreneurs that are going out there, they do their product, and then they're, caught in lawsuits with the, larger companies?
Okay, let me start with the second one, intellectual property. So here's what the intellectual property issues around this will be thorny, as they are on so many dimensions online. The intellectual property issue that I think is, from a policy perspective, perhaps most salient here is how the disclosure requirements will affect the types of projects that lend themselves to crowdfunding. So, for example, in the case of the Pebble Watch, the entrepreneur was willing to and didn't feel that his ability to build and sell his product would be so adversely affected by his revealing what he was working on early stage. In other words, one of the benefits of going to an angel or a VC is you can keep everything secret until much later in the process. In this case, he had to reveal a lot of information early on before he'd even begun manufacturing. Moreover, we think of companies who are building a new product and manufacturing them in China, doing everything they can to keep their everything secret of what's going on in the factory and so on and so forth. And if you go to this platform, in order for him to keep his investment community feeling reasonably supportive because their watches are late and so on, he's taking pictures all through the factory, he's posting them on the web, he's trying to show people, look at what we're doing to make sure you get a great watch. My point here being, I think that crowdfunding will favor the types of ventures for whom disclosure won't be particularly harmful. So stated another way, if you think of harm from public disclosure being on a spectrum for different types of ventures, those that are on the less harm end of the spectrum will be the ones that will be more likely to want to use crowdfunding as a way of raising capital. With regards to your first question of states, I'm not sure that I followed what the essence of the question was in terms of whether you were thinking about regulatory, you mean in terms of regulating the projects that get posted on crowdfunding?
It's primarily the nonprofits being required to register in the states to solicit. If you're going by way of the web and it's crowdfunding, do you see, because of states and their shortfalls
right,
in
so
budget,
but right now they're not issuing, they're, because, for example, Kickstarter isn't issuing, no one's getting tax receipts. So that, in other words, it's not being considered a charitable donation, that they're not subject to that scrutiny. Yes.
We had a fascinating question earlier about the trade-offs between companies going public and being acquired by larger companies. And the question was, what was the bottom line impact on innovation? And I guess I'd be interested in your thoughts here as well. Do you think this is a kind of setting where, you know, if you're something which is sort of faddish and cool, you know, some sort of social media thing, it's going to tend to be the kind of things that get funding here, and the sort of stuff that you might think is, you know, more revolutionary are going to find it much harder to get funding, you know, let's say a biotech or a clean tech thing that will take many years to realize? Or do you think it's going to be more even in terms of some of the impact it's going to have on the on what kind of technologies get favored through crowdfunding?
Sure, that's a great question. So I think, I mean, there are some enthusiasts of the crowdfunding world who would argue the opposite, that in fact their view is that traditional capital is far too conservative, and that the real visionaries that are able to allocate their capital through crowdfunding and spread the risk in a way that is harder to do through traditional forms will indeed fund more risky and exploratory projects. I suspect, for example, as I noted in the first point, that the Pebble Watch was able to attract a lot of attention through crowdfunding and the types of people who would want to support that because it was going to consumers. In other words, there was another device that was basically a gesture control device, it was very cool, but is not a device that people would be able to use directly. It would be the type of device that would likely be sold to a Sony or a company like that. And that project was not able, just didn't attract the user investor attention that the Pebble Watch did, probably for a variety of reasons. But basically, that was a venture that was going to build a product and ultimately have to sell it to, sell it to a company rather than sell it to a consumer. So I think, just to wrap up on that one, I think the jury's out. I mean, in the sense that we won't know until we see equity-based crowdfunding here how adventuresome crowdfunding investors are. But I think there is certainly reason to believe that they might be equally adventuresome. But you had two things bundled in your suggestion. One was the degree of venturesomeness, and the other was just the amount of capital. Life science projects require so much more capital than software or even hardware. That the crowd might not be up for that scale of an investment. There's one more question here.
We have 30 seconds.
30 seconds, okay.
I think we should probably end by giving you a round of applause.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Hi. As promised, we have kept people here for a long day. But we have a grand finale to wrap up wrap this session up. And in particular, we have Congressman Jim Himes as our keynote. I think he's, sort of really is quite unique in terms of having a perspective that really very much bridges the worlds of private finance as well as the public sector challenges. And as a result, we'll be very interested in hearing what he has to say. It's a long, long resume with lots of things on it. I won't sort of belabor it. He represents the 4th Congressional District of Connecticut. He's in the second term of Congress, serves on the Financial Services Committee. He's a product of my institution and a Rhodes Scholar. He's spent a fair amount of time both in the
world of private finance and at Goldman, ultimately heading up the bank's telecommunications technology group, as well as also running the New York City branch of the Enterprise Community Partners, which essentially was, I guess you'd describe as sort of social venture capital in the sense of trying to address some housing needs. So without further ado, we'll turn the floor over to Congressman Hines. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.